And I'm Ben Schumacher. I'm going to be your instructor for this course for the next 3 weeks. And I guess the first thing that I want to say is that quantum theory is a huge subject, and we're not going to cover it all. Quantum theory is, in a lot of ways, the heart of what physics is these days. There's simply too many important things to distill them all into 3 weeks. And in fact, if you sort of looked at the quantum theory course that was taught in this program last year by Malcolm Perry, a great course, and you looked at the course that I'm teaching this year, which we'll see, you'll find that the overlap is maybe 25%. So the core ideas of quantum theory, 25% overlap. Why is that? Well, part of it is that I'm essentially being motivated by some different concerns than Perry was, and let me sort of bring that out to be honest with you. A lot of the topics that I'm going to choose to talk about are motivated by a concern with quantum information and quantum computation, and also with the foundations of quantum theory. These are subjects I find very fascinating. And then, to a somewhat lesser extent, things like quantum field theory. And there are lots of reasons for this. One reason, a very important reason, is I think these subjects are very accessible ways to come to grips with really important ideas about quantum theory. And so that's how we're going to organize the class. So you've all had an undergraduate course in quantum mechanics. And so a typical undergraduate course in quantum mechanics will be very much concerned with stationary states of systems, energy eigenstates and eigenvalues. That's sort of the bread and butter of your course. And you'll mostly be dealing with individual, single, isolated systems, a particle moving in one dimension or something like that. And the basic organizing principle of the course would be spectroscopy. You know, what are the energy eigenstates? What are transitions between energy eigenstates? The kind of information that would be very important if you went and looked at some sort of spectrum of absorption or emission from an atomic system. That's a great sort of thing to do, but it's not what we're going to do. For us, we'll concentrate on the dynamics of quantum systems and their time evolution. And that'll be what we'll particularly pay attention to in week number one. And we're going to think a lot about composite systems, systems with subsystems, systems composed of parts, and open systems, systems that are interacting with their environment. And that will be something that we'll concentrate on in week number two. And our organizing principle, though it won't always be obvious, But our organizing principle will be the idea of information and the role that idea plays in the quantum world. As I say, that won't always be obvious, but it'll be really obvious in week three. So that's kind of our structure of the course. Our emphasis in the course is going to be on fundamental concepts rather than problem-solving techniques. You'll work plenty of problems, but I hope that every one of them is teaching a fundamental concept. So that's what I see as my business. Our mathematical level will be, I think, compared to some of the other courses you'll have here, unsophisticated, naive, even pedestrian. And the reason for that is that I think, especially after we get through the first couple of days, you'll begin to see some new ideas. And I think it's often very useful to see new ideas in a naive way without the most elegant and deepest mathematical disguise that you can put on them. So we'll try to keep it as simple as possible, but not simpler, to quote Einstein. So for example, we'll often be happy to talk about Hilbert spaces that are of finite dimension. Lots of really useful examples occur there. Lots of the fundamental ideas already show up with finite dimensional spaces. My wife is a mathematician. She's a functional analyst. She believes that vector spaces of finite dimension are fundamentally trivial. But she's not teaching the course. I am, and so we'll often be in that context. Finally, final note in this introductory session here, the role of questions. Questions are allowed. No. Questions are encouraged. No. Questions are essential. Okay? If I'm being obscure, clarify. If I'm making a mistake, save me. And if I ask you a question, feel free to volunteer an answer. Because I think that two-way communication is going to be good. If I'm asking a question, one of the things I want to know is what are you thinking? And so if you don't say anything, then I won't know what you're thinking. It'll be very frustrating for me. I'll throw my chalk or something. Okay, so, all right. So let's start. First of all, any questions?
Mechanics course should start out with the double slit experiment, right? That's sort of a traditional place to begin. So let me begin there. Everybody knows the double slit experiment. You have a source of particles. Particles are going to be described by some sort of wave function, and you'll have a barrier that has a couple of slits. Here's slit A. Here's slit B. And you'll have a screen over here where you have some detectors, and the particles emerging from slit A are described by some sort of wave function psi A, and particles emerging from slit B would be described by some wave function psi sub B. And then, when you go over to the screen, these things have propagated. So I'm really wanting to think of this as time, moving to the right. And over here, well, the waves reach here, and they evolve a bit. Maybe they spread out a bit. Here's psi A prime and psi B prime, something similar. Okay. And here's what we find. We find that if we only have slit A, then we have psi A over here, and that evolves in time over to psi A prime over here. And if we only have slit B open, then psi B evolves to psi B prime. This wave would propagate into something like that. But what makes the two-slit experiment interesting is what happens when we have both slits and then we have a superposition of psi A and psi B, a wave function composed of two parts, one representing the particles going through slit A, one representing the particles going through slit B. And that evolves to the superposition psi A prime plus psi B prime. And of course, it's this wave function that we see the interference at the screen, in which we see the interference at the screen. Okay. So what's the moral of this story? The moral of this story is that this is a linear process. That the evolution of the wave function from the slits to the screen is linear. It takes a superposition of wave functions to a superposition of wave functions. Now, under what circumstances would this be true? What's an important physical assumption I'm making here? Not quite a rhetorical question, but I'm going to pause here to see if you can come up with something. Yeah?
The wave functions make a vector space, so it makes sense about talking about Addington them together.
Absolutely. The wave function make a vector space. We're always going to be living inside a complex vector space, the Hilbert space, absolutely. That's sort of the underlying structure of the theory. Very good. I'm actually thinking about a physical assumption about the setup that I'm making.
The slit
small enough. No, actually, this doesn't really depend on the size of the slit. Yes?
So the distance from the spring to the slit. If it's too small, then you can't really get interference.
Well, it's true. That's true that the wave functions won't have much overlap because I've drawn them, so you won't see any interference. But this would still be true if the slit, if this was right here. Yeah?
You would still get the same result with a single photon source?
Yes, we still get the same result with a single photon source. These wave functions don't describe, these wave functions actually describe, will allow us to calculate the probabilities for finding a particular particle in a single particle experiment. Yes?
There are no disturbances in the middle.
Okay, that's very close, and we're gonna take that one and run with it. That is that they're not disturbed. What kind of thing might disturb this situation? Yeah.
If you're not measuring one of the two.
Okay.
Which direction?
Right, I would give you a prize if I had a prize. That's it. What's happening is there's no measurement that's been made. It's not quite that the system is isolated. The system, for example, can be influenced by external forces. It's a lovely neutron interferometry experiment in which this is done by a gravitational field, and you can actually see the effect on the interference pattern due to the fact that these two paths are at different heights above the ground. It's really wonderful. But anyway, it's not quite that they're isolated, but they are kind of isolated in that no measurement is made. And by measurement, I don't mean that no experimenter finds out whether it's A or B. I mean that there's no physical record made anywhere. That this thing is sufficiently isolated. It's informationally isolated. It doesn't leave any trace of what slit it went through. And under those circumstances, we can expect linear evolution in time. If there's nothing like a measure. So right away, at the very beginning, in the first hand-waving thought experiment we write down, we see that the concept of information is already playing a role in quantum theory. I won't talk about this much for a while, but I just want you to know that there's a kind of informational assumption at work that the system is sufficiently isolated that no physical record is made of which slit the particle went through. And in that case, the evolution is linear. So let's go to our more abstract theory, which lives in a linear space. And then this question about informational isolation. Let me write that down. Informational isolation. That's clearly going to require further discussion. So stay tuned. 2 weeks from now, we'll come back and think about that. Okay, so let's fix a time interval. A time interval from T1 to T2. And let's consider the evolution of a quantum system. The quantum system might be in various possible states. It might be in the state psi, and that evolves into the state psi prime. It might be in the state phi. That evolves in the state phi prime. And our linearity assumption says that a linear combination of these two, A psi plus B phi, should evolve to a linear combination of the time of all states.
Yeah. Do those A's and B's have to be the same?
Yes, that's the whole point. These A's and B's aren't the same. These coefficients don't evolve. If this evolves to that and this evolves to that, this superposition with these coefficients evolves to a superposition with the same coefficients of the time of all states. So that's a very important thing. What that means is that the connection between the future state and the past state of the system must be represented by a linear operator on our space of states. So we have a time evolution operator. So that psi of t2 is equal to an operator, which I'll call u. It's a function of the ending time and the beginning time acting on the state at t1. There has to be an operator that tells me the rule by which quantum states evolve in time from one time to the next. And so what we want to do is spend a lot of time thinking about u. Let us say u, not necessarily u, but this group. Okay. And so I want to go over a few important facts about u. We'll mention just a few important points now. We're going to spend actually the whole week thinking about you. Okay, so the important points. Well, the first important point is that this operator u must be unitary. Must be a unitary operator. What do I mean? What's that? What does that mean? Well, let's think about it. We have psi prime, which is u times psi. That's the future state of the system. That's the past state. This is the operator that connects them. And the point here is that this state, being a physical state of the system, is normalized. That the initial state is a normalized state. That's the number one. Okay. But the state has to remain normalized. This this would have to do with, if you were to think about the probabilities of outcomes of a measurement, the probabilities have to sum to one. And it's saying sum to one in the past, they sum to one in the future. That boils down to normalization of the state vector. So this has got to be true. Has to be. Must be. But of course, this I can write, well, let's see, the Bra of psi prime would be the sort of the adjoint of this. And so let's remember how that happens. When I take the adjoint of something, I reverse all the orders of the multiplications. I change scalars to their complex conjugates, bras to cats to cats to bras, and operators to their adjoints. So this would be psi dagger, and then psi prime, of course, is just u psi. Okay, so what I have is that for any normalized vector psi, this matrix element, this inner product, has to be 1. And from that it follows, since this is true for every, or for any, psi with psi psi into 1. Since that's true, it follows that the operator here has to be the identity operator. Now, in the tutorial today, you're going to work a problem that'll do that. It'll show you why that's true in general, and that's a really handy kind of fact. If you know something about matrix elements like this, then you know a lot about the operator. We'll pick up the mathematical details. I'll let you turn the page yourself and see where that goes. But it follows from this that u dagger u is equal to the identity operator. And this all by itself, if the dimension of the Hilbert space is finite, this also implies that u dagger is the identity. U dagger is the identity. And we'll assume that that's also true for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. That'll be a requirement that we make for our time evolution operator. So this is actually an assumption. For infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And so these two conditions together, if u dagger u equals u dagger equals the identity, then we say that the operator is unitary. That's what it means, the unitary. How could this not necessarily be, how could this not necessarily follow infinite Hilbert space? But sort of like a combinatorial thing. If I have a finite set, a set of seven elements, let's say, and I have a one-to-one function from that set to another set of seven elements, I know automatically that the function is onto. But if I have an infinite set, and I have a one-to-one function to another infinite set of the same cardinality, I don't know that that function is onto. And in a certain sense, this condition is really the one-to-one condition, and this condition is really the onto condition when viewed in terms of, say, a basis set for infinite space. And so in infinite spaces, you can get infinite dimensional spaces. You can lose this implication. Okay. If that didn't make any sense to you, it's okay. It's not important. I'll try to alert you to things that I'm saying just because my mathematical conscience is bothering me. Your conscience may not be so haunted by memories of rigor. Okay. All right. So that's one important thing. Let's consider another important idea. Let's consider an interval of time that's broken up into two intervals. So t1 goes to t2, which goes to t3. And the system is informationally isolated over the whole thing. Well then, the time evolution operator from t1 to t3 is the product of time evolution operators for the two stages of the evolution. And let me show you how that's written. T2, U, T2, T1. Notice the order. The first stage of the evolution appears on the right, and then the second stage of the evolution appears on the left. And that makes all kinds of sense because you're going to apply this to a state which sits on the right, and so this has got to be the first one that acts, and then the second one acts. Okay? So when you read a sequence, a product of unitary operators, you need to read it from right to left. Okay. Now, it's also true that any product of unitary operators is unitary. So that's useful.
Ordering of the time in the bracket changes when you take the Hermitian conjugate?
Oh, we take the Hermitian conjugate. Yes, although I haven't said what u dagger would represent in terms of time evolution. So when you take the Hermitian conjugate of this, so if you have, we'll just quickly write this as u32 is equal to u31 is equal to u32, u21, here's a sort of dot compact notation, and u31 dagger is going to be u21 dagger times u32 dagger, because the rule for taking Hermitian conjugates is that you reverse all the orders of the multiplication, which is a familiar rule from taking things like matrix transposes and so on. Okay? Yeah. Okay, good. Some of you are actually happy, which I don't quite understand, but you'll be happier later. Okay, so I want to tell you something about the eigenstates and eigenvalues of u. So eigenstates. Okay. So let's remember some operator stuff. unitary operators are normal. You know what normal means? Okay. Unitary operators. Unitary implies normal. A normal operator, normal is the most overused word in all of mathematics. In this case, normal means that an operator commutes with its conjugate. Okay? So permission operators are normal because they are their conjugates. Anti-permission operators are normal because they're the negatives of their conjugates. Unitary operators are normal because u dagger u and u dagger are both equal to the identity. So all kinds of interesting classes of operators are normal operators. And the great thing about normal operators is that's the class of operators that has an orthogonal basis set of eigenvectors. Okay? The normal operators are the ones that have an orthogonal eigenbasis. And when I say basis, you can just assume, unless it's in some metaphorical context, but when I talk about a vector space basis, I mean an orthonormal basis unless otherwise announced. Okay? Normal operators have orthonormal eigenbases by bases. That is to say, a normal operator has an orthonormal basis composed of eigenvectors of the operator. And in the case of a unitary operator, that's a very handy thing. Let's consider what an eigen. Let's suppose you have an eigenvalue omega for u. Then u acting on the eigenvalue will be omega acting on that. Okay? And so what does normalization tell us? If I take the square norm of this over here, I have that omega u dagger u omega, which I'm going to take to be 1, the number 1. That's got to equal to, well, when I work this out, I get this times its complex conjugate, which gives me the magnitude of omega squared times omega omega, which is just the magnitude of omega squared. And that means that if I have an eigenvalue for a unitary operator, that eigenvalue must be a complex number with unit modulus. That is to say, from this it means that omega is equal to e to the I some real phase. Okay? And when I see something like this, I think that. The eigenvalues of a unitary operator have all be of this form. These are the complex numbers with unit modulus. And so that means that when I write the unitary operator in its spectral form, that is to say, in terms of its eigenvectors and eigenvalues, then I'll write something like this. That the unitary operator is equal to the sum over the eigenbasis of the eigenvalue, which is always of this form, e to the I alpha sub k times the outer product of the eigenbases, the eigenbasis vectors. Excuse me.
I probably just made a tremendous pumping noise.
Okay. All right. Have you ever seen this way of writing an operator before? It's the sum of eigenvalues times the projections onto the various eigenvectors. And you can see, for example, if I brought in an eigenvector, this sum would pick out one of them, because the eigenvectors were orthogonal to each other, this sum would pick out one of them and multiply it by the corresponding eigenvalue. And so, since the sum does the right thing to the eigenvalues, or to the eigenvectors, it must do the right thing to all the vectors, because any vector can be written as a sum of elements from this basis of eigenvectors. So is this at all familiar? Okay, good. I see nods. If it's not, talk to you later, we'll play with it. Okay, so that's so these are the three general things I want to say. I also want to talk about particularly important special situation. And that's the situation of what we're going to call uniform dynamics. Uniform dynamics. Okay, what do I mean by uniform dynamics? What I mean by uniform dynamics is that the unitary operator that takes me from T1 to T2 is a function only of the amount of time that has elapsed between T1 and T2. So, okay, the state at 1 o'clock is not the same as the state at 1:05. The state at 2 o'clock is not the same as the state at 2:05. But the rule that takes you from a state now to a state 5 minutes from now is the same at 1 o'clock and at 2 o'clock. The rule that takes you 5 minutes into the future is the same rule over time. It only depends on 5 minutes, the length of the time interval. And so that means that instead of having to keep track of two arguments for the time evolution operator, I really only need to keep track of one thing, namely the elapsed time between the beginning and the end of the time interval I'm talking about. So uniform dynamics, that's a situation that's going to very often pertain to a system, and to pretty much any system if we look at it in a very fundamental way, because presumably the time evolution operator is a result of some kind of underlying laws of physics. And the laws of physics, at least to the approximation we'll take in this class, laws of physics don't change from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock. It's going to be the same time evolution operator. Now, of course, if we have a more restricted view of the world, if we're only really considering the spin in our NMR system, and we think of the magnetic field as some external parameter that we can just turn up and down, we're not sort of including ourselves and the whole universe in our situation, then it might be that we don't do the same thing to the magnetic field at 1 o'clock that we do at 2 o'clock, and this uniform dynamics assumption would not hold. But this is going to be an important special case. We'll often restrict to this case. It's a very fundamental kind of situation. Okay, uniform dynamics, and so I can write things as a function of a single parameter, the elapsed time, and suppose I have something like this. So I have the elapsed time S followed by the elapsed time T. And I have this product. Well, what is this product going to be? This is 1 minute and 2 minutes here. What's the product going to be? Well, it's going to be the time evolution operator for 3 minutes, right? Because this says evolve for 1 minute, it says evolve for 2 minutes afterwards. Okay, so this is going to be, doesn't matter which order it is. So this is an important characteristic of the family of unitary operators that would describe uniform dynamics of a quantum system. That the time argument is just additive. Okay, let's see, what about what's a U of zero? the time evolution operator corresponding to no time. It's the identity, right? Here's another thing we're going to do. We're going to assume that the evolution is smooth, which means we're going to assume that that the time evolution over a very short interval of time is something close to the identity. That is to say, it's going to be the identity plus something of order epsilon. That's a that's the assumption we're going to make, the smoothness assumption of the time evolution. Okay. Okay. It gives us continuity and actual differentiability for the for our time evolution. Okay. Questions about uniform dynamics. Okay. And kind of the punchline. If you take this assumption and you go back to the spectral form, the spectral form, so called, not because it's ghostly, but because it contains the spectrum of eigenvalues explicitly. If you go back to the spectral form, the, you could think of this as a kind of a diagonal representation. Then this uniform dynamics assumption tells you something about these things. Because all of these guys are going to commute with each other. All of the time evolution operators for different times are all going to be commuting. Because, of course, this times this is equal to this, but it's also the case that it'll be the same thing if you multiply them in the opposite order. And so they're all going to have the same eigenbasis. They'll just have different eigenvalues. And the uniform dynamics assumption turns out to imply that these eigenvalues are such that these phase factors are linear in time. The phase factors linearly increase with time, or linearly change with time. Okay? And so it turns out that in uniform dynamics, U of t is equal to the sum over k of a phase factor, and there's a conventional there's a conventional minus sign here, and it really is conventional. There's this one choice of sign that is completely universal in quantum mechanics, and we're now setting it right now. Okay, so here it is, minus I omega sub k t. Okay, so the phase factors are proportional to t. We have the same eigenbasis for all values of t, and I have a little minus sign here, which is conventional. So this is what the spectral form of the time evolution operator for uniform dynamics would be. I completely solve the dynamics of the system if I know this operator. I know everything. And of course, to know this operator, what do you need? You need to know the eigenbasis, you need to know the omegas. So let's suppose psi, and we'll call psi sub n of 0, is equal to n. It's one of the the eigenbasis vectors here. It's one of these guys. Well then, what does this guy look like at a later time? Well, let's see. It's ut acting on n, which is equal to, let's do this, it's the sum over k of e to the minus I omega k t. Hey, by the way, I sometimes write this, when I write it, I just make it x. But of course, that's a bra followed by a ket. This is a quick thing that I learned to do on a blackboard. It takes me a half a second less time to do this. I've now used up all the time I'm going to save for the entire course by explaining what I mean by this. But it's a habit now. I get up. And so then when I write that, even though my hand goes zit zit, don't think of it as an x. It's bra all the ket.
Ket bra.
All right, ket all the bra, sorry. That's why I need to read the instrument. Okay, now, and then, okay, this whole thing is acting on the vector n. Of course, the inner product of k and n is the delta function, is the product of delta. Delta k and n, because they're orthonormal. We can use the product of delta to do the sum over k, because every term will be zero except the one where k happens to be equal to n. And therefore, this gives me, if I use this chalkboard, terrible destructive of the chalk. This gives me e to the minus I omega n t of n. Okay, and that's psi n of t. Okay, I want to make a couple of inferences from this expression. The first inference is that this state only differs from the initial state by an overall phase. And as you may remember, an overall phase in the state vector has no measurable consequences. It doesn't affect any expectation value of any observable. And so this is physically indistinguishable from this. And that means that the effect of of the uniform dynamics on one of its eigenstates is that it doesn't change any physical properties of the eigenstates. The eigenstates are, in fact, stationary states. They're called stationary states. These guys, k is a stationary state. The only thing that it changes over time is its phase. And its phase does not by itself have any significance. If the dynamics is not uniform, there do not necessarily exist any stationary states. But if the dynamics is uniform, there's a complete basis of stationary states. Okay, now. You guys are probably more familiar with a different way of looking at the dynamics. And you probably heard about the Schrodinger equation. Let's see where that comes from. Okay, so we're going to have uniform, do I have uniform dynamics? Actually, it doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter. So I'll take psi at time t. That's going to equal some kind of evolution operator from some initial time t0 acting on the initial state of psi t0. And so the thing that I want to point out is that the only thing that depends on time here is that operator. And so, the derivative with respect to time of psi of t is equal to some operator g, which may itself be a function of time, acting on psi of t. And what is g? G is nothing but the... That's good enough. Okay, this and so what can we say about g? Yeah.
T0.
No. So what is g? I'll just tell you what g is. All right.
Okay, that piece of chalk is not evident as a ball, so not put in the chalk. Okay.
So, what is g? let's see. When I take this. So let's work out what this is. That's going to be the derivative with respect to t of u of t naught
acting on psi of p0, right? Okay, but I can write this as the derivative with respect to t of t, of u of t, t naught times u dagger t, t naught times u of t, t naught, because of course it's unitary, so that's just the identity. And this is actually for my general dynamics. This is actually the thing I mean by G. Okay. But all I want to point out here is that this is a linear equation. Its time derivative is a linear equation. Its time derivative is a linear equation. This is what I mean. Okay. This is what I mean. Simply that the time derivative is given by a linear function, a linear operator acting on this thing. And so now I want to find out some things about G. Well, what do I know about G? Well, once again, I'm going to get information, I'm going to get properties of my operator by simply considering the fact that the normalization of the state can't change. And so the derivative with respect to time of psi of t, that had better be zero. The derivative with respect to time of this inner product of the state with itself had better be zero, because the state had better maintain normalization over time. And of course, that's we can apply the product rule here. Which does work for inner product, by the way. Which is a fun little exercise if you're worried about it. And this is a thing you should always do. If somebody says something in an offhand way and you say, "Oh, I'm not sure that's true," you can either ask why it's true, or you can go off and work it out for yourself. I will try not to do anything like that, which is not really easy to work out things. Okay. Okay, so what do I have here? I have that that there will be two terms in the time derivative of this inner product, one where the bra is changing in time, the other where the cat's changing in time. This will simply be, by taking the adjoint of this equation, this will simply be psi. Boy. Write more softly these chunks. Dagger psi plus psi g psi. That is to say, cross psi g dagger plus g cat psi. And that's got to be zero for any normalized psi that you might happen to the state that might happen to be in at the time equal to p. So if that's zero for all normalized psi, what does that tell me about the operator that is in the inner product? That's right. Tells me that this operator is zero, and that, so g dagger must be equal to minus g, so this is anti-Hermitian. Okay, and so if you have an anti-Hermitian operator, what do you do with it? Well, you write it as I times the Hermitian operator, of course. It's very simple. And so what we do is we define H, possibly a time-dependent operator. We define H to be I times H bar times G. And so H is Hermitian. That's why we call it age. Okay, not me. Okay? We threw in another age just to be sure. By the way, this is one of the ways you can tell that we're going to take the pedestrian mathematical approach, because most of the time, I'm going to act in h-bars in my equations. That's a... If you want to just leave them out of your notes, that'd be fine. Okay, most of the time I'll put them in. Okay, so then if you have this, then this equation simply becomes that h acting on the vector psi is equal to I h bar times the derivative with respect to time of psi. So there's this Hermitian operator. There's this Hermitian operator which has this property. It tells you how the time derivative is. And that's the Schrodinger equation. Okay. What did I knock out of the Schrodinger equation? The Schrodinger equation is a definition of H, exactly. And so I don't have any physical significance for H built in. And that's the problem. What can I say about H? What can I say about H? Well, what is H? What is H? I have to investigate this physically. One of the reasons I include H bar here is that I want to note that this H has units. The units of G is inverse time. When I multiply inverse seconds times joule seconds, I get joules. So H has units of energy. That's kind of interesting. H has units of energy. And indeed, the other physical principle that I have to invoke here is the Planck rule that says that energies and frequencies are related. Now,
how do we know that H has units of energy?
Oh, because G, from this definition of G, G must have units of inverse time. H is, by definition, G times something which has energy, energy times time units, and therefore the units of H have units of energy. It must be units of energy. That's all. Yeah?
You just stick an H bar arbitrarily.
I stuck an H bar so that the next thing I write down will be relevant. I did. I mean, when I did this, I did it because I saw this in a book and I wanted to make it look like that. But if I do this, then I have the Planck relation, the very first piece of quantum theory, Planck relation, which is that energies are related to frequencies. Planck wrote a little bit differently. You know, H bar, whatever you think of. And what does that mean? Well, let's suppose that we look at a stationary state. Let's suppose we look at a stationary state like we did right here. What do we get if I act with H on this stationary state, which I happen to still have here in a box? Okay? Well, this tells me that should be I H bar times the derivative with respect to time of, and this tells me that's e to the minus I omega n t times the original state. Of course, when I take the derivative of the exponential, I'll just get the factor of p, the coefficient of p here. So I get I H bar times minus I omega sub n times this thing, which is just psi n p. I get minus I is 1, so I get H bar omega n psi n of p. And this is H bar times the frequency associated with that stationary state. It's the frequency with which that stationary state phase rotates. And so this motivates me to set the claim that this should be an energy associated with this state. There should be an energy associated with this state. So, H
psi n of t is equal to zn psi n of t. The phase doesn't matter, h acting on n is equal to e sub n acting on n. Okay, from this, I deduce that for uniform dynamics, remember, here I'm talking about uniform dynamics, I had better remind myself of that. For uniform dynamics, it makes sense to interpret H as the energy operator. H stands for Hamiltonian. The energy operator is the energy observable. It's a Hermitian operator whose eigenvalues should be energies. And the stationary states of uniform dynamics are exactly the energy eigenstates. And the frequencies of the stationary states are related by h bar to the energies of the energy eigenstates. And I can figure out all those frequencies for that basis of energy eigenstates by solving the energy eigenvalue equation, which is also known as the time-independent Schrödinger equation. It's all there. So the Planck relation motivates us to assert that h is the energy that is the Hamiltonian operator. But I want to tell you that the real important the real importance of H is this, that H is the operator that generates, that tells me how dynamics happens. That all the other things about H are secondary to this. The fact that it's the energy operator allows us to figure out how to write down H in various quantum systems, but in fact, this is where the real physical significance of H lies. Okay, I'm learning how far I'm going to get today. Well, we may have one of the problems this afternoon be a little bit of a problem about the future, but we'll see how that works out. Okay, so now we have dynamics figured out. For dynamics as described by a unitary operator, in the case of uniform dynamics, that operator is a function only of the elapsed time. The instantaneous instantaneous change of the state vector is given by the Hamiltonian operator. In this case, H is causally dependent on t in this equation. I haven't assumed uniform dynamics here, but if I assume uniform dynamics, I find that H should be interpreted as the energy operator, and that the frequencies of the stationary states are related to the energies of the energy eigenstates. In fact, the stationary states and the energy eigenstates are the same. That's where we are. Questions about that circle of ideas? I'm about to raise the board. Okay. Wish we had a bigger board. As long as I just, I wish I had a bigger reason. Okay. The state changes. And because the state changes, various observable properties change. In particular, we're interested in the expectation value of an observable changes. So let's suppose we have an observable K. And of course it's Hermitian. What does Hermitian tell us about the eigenvalues of A?
They're real.
They're real eigenvalues. What does it tell me about the eigenstates of A? Orthogonal to each other, or distinct eigenvalues. And so What I'm really going to be thinking about is the expectation. Which is this inner product. This is the expectation value of the observable A. Now, I'm going to make a simplifying assumption, so I'm not going to do this in complete generality. I'm just doing the simple case. I'm going to assume that the operator itself is not time independent. The operator, that the observable itself is not time independent. And that would be like, you know, particle talking in space, the x-coordinate part. But what I mean by the x-coordinate wouldn't necessarily be changing in time. Physically, what I might say is that the apparatus that I would use for measuring A isn't time dependent. It's the same, I use the same apparatus to measure, in the same configuration to measure the position at this time that I would to measure the position 5 minutes later. So same apparatus, same operator. Okay. And however, this is independent of time, but the states depend on time. So how does this change? That's what I want to find out. How does the expectation value of A change over time? And of course, that's just going to be I'm just going to apply the product rule to this inner product. I'm going to have this term, where it's the bra that's changing, plus this term, where is the ket that's changing. I'm going to now invoke the Schrodinger equation, which I will write as the derivative with respect to time of psi is equal to 1 over I h bar. H psi. Okay? And so let's see. This will give me minus 1 over I h bar psi h a psi. First one minus because I have to take the Hermitian conjugate of that equation to get an equation for this, and the minus comes from the fact that I goes to minus I under that operation. And then add to that 1 over I h bar psi a h psi. Oh, but this is great because I see that the common factor 1 over I h bar, and I've got a h minus h a, the commutator, and so I get the wonderful equation that the derivative with respect to time of the expectation of A is simply 1 over I h bar times psi commutator A with h psi. This is kind of neat. Commutators are really interesting. Commutators, it seems to all be in the commutator somehow. Commutators, as you know, are key ingredient in uncertainty relations. That the commutator between two operators tells you whether or not those operators are compatible, or if they're not, how the dispersions between those operators must be related. Maybe you remember that. But here we see that it's also related to the time rate of change of an observable quantity. It has to do with the commutator of that quantity with the Hamiltonian. Now, the first thing I want to note about that is that if the commutator of the observable with the Hamiltonian is zero, then expectation value of A is constant, and that's true for any. That's true no matter what the state psi is at this particular moment. And so we say that A is a conserved quantity. Conserved quantities are ones that commute with the Hamiltonian. That means that no matter what the state is, that the rate of change of the expectation is zero. We'll have a better way of looking at that probably next time. And finally, let me work out something in particular about this. And that is, let's go back to our friend, the particle moving in one dimension. There we have we have a Hamiltonian which can be written in terms of the position and momentum operators this way. And I'm going to use V for my potential, because I've got a lot of use right there. And I want to mention the commutation relations. The commutators are important. Mention some commutation relations. The first one is one you know. You know that the commutator of X and P is equal to what? Right? It's I, H bar, times the identity operator. Excess of fastidious and so on. Okay. But from this, you can actually get some more commutation relations that are really interesting. For example, you can get that if you have a function of x and commute it with p, you get I h bar times f prime of x. You can see this is a special case of this one. And if you have x and some function of p, you get I h bar times the derivative of that function of p. Now, how would you get these? How would you get these?
Expansion.
Hmm? Taylor expansion. Yes, you use a Taylor expansion. Let me just absolutely power series is the way to get it. Let me just remind you of how that goes, just in a minute, because I don't want to spend too much time on that. The first thing is to note the following useful identity. If you have the product of A and B and you take the commutator of that with C, then that's A times the commutator of B and C plus the commutator of A and C times B. And that's trivial proof. You write down both sides and they're the same. And it's a very handy thing to know. So in your bag of tricks, in your little toolbox you carry with you every operator calculation, this should be one of them. And the second thing is, using this, we can get something like this by induction. You can find out that x to the n p is equal to I h bar n x to the n minus 1. And you prove this for n equal to 1, and that's just what we have up there. And then, given x to the n, you can write x to the n plus 1 as x times x to the n, and then you can use this guy to get you this result by induction, by mathematical induction. And then, you write f of x as a power series. You write f x as a power series, and you can apply this trick to every term in the power series. And voila, you get these lovely relations. Once again, this is a great thing to work on if you've forgotten how to do this, or you haven't done it before. Once in your life, you should work this out. It's very pretty. Okay. So let's take the particle moving in one dimension and take our basic result there, which I'll rewrite here so that I can erase that board. The derivative with respect to time of the expectation of A, 1 over I h bar psi A h psi. Let's work out the derivatives of expectations for positions and momentum. And the derivative with respect to time of x therefore be 1 over I h bar times psi x p squared over 2 mu plus v of x psi. Of course, x commutes with v of x. X commutes with any function of x. X doesn't quite commute with v squared, but I can use this identity right here, and I get 1 over I h bar times, well, let's see, 1 over 2 mu times psi xp squared psi is equal to 1 over I h bar 1 over 2 mu psi, I h bar 2p psi. This I h bar cancels that I h bar, this 2 cancels that 2, and I get the expectation value of momentum divided by mu, which makes all kinds of sense. Because this is like a velocity. This is the expectation value of momentum over the mass. Okay, that makes sense. In the same way, when I work out the derivative with respect to time of the expectation value of momentum, I get 1 over I h bar, and you know how it's going to be. It's going to have a commutator of p with p squared over 2 mu plus v of x. The p squared will commute with p. V of x won't commute with p. I'll be able to apply this identity. Of course, there'll be a minus sign because they're in the other order. And so this will give me minus the expectation of v prime of x. In other words, this is the expectation of the force, classical force, as a function of x, because that's the derivative of v with respect to t, the minus sign. And that is like the classical equation of motion. By the way, these two things together are called Ehrenfest theorem. Everybody seen them? This is almost, but not quite, saying that the expected position of momentum follow the classical equation of motion. Why is this not just saying that this does not say that the expectation values of position and momentum simply follow the classical equations of motion? What's the difference between these and the classical equations of motion?
The classical equations of motion that are no states.
Nevertheless, the classical equations of motion are differential equations for time-dependent variables. And if I just pick my time-dependent variables to be this number and that number, why doesn't this give me the equations of motion for a classical system?
Because the expectation value is like orthogonal average.
The expectation values don't tell me everything about what I would observe, but they do tell me something. Okay? And so if I were willing to just live with the statistical averages, why isn't this exactly the classical equations of motion?
Because the average of x is not f on average of x?
He gets another promise. Yes, the average, because the average of f of x, this average, is not the same thing as f of the average. This is not the same thing. If this were what appeared here, then I'd have the classical equations of motion for expectations for x and p. But this is not the same, and so things are not the same. Now, sometimes it is the same. For example, if the wave function has a very narrow width, if its spread in x values is very small, then the difference between these might be negligible, and then I have approximately classical equations of motion. So I have a narrow wave packet that should evolve pretty well with the classical equations of motion, which I'll just. Mu and p classical dot is equal to f of x plus. Those are the classical equations of motion. However, the other circumstance is it might be that v contains no more than quadratic terms in the position. And if that's true, then F contains no more than linear terms, and then the expectation is a linear business, and so this would equal to that. So you do get exactly the classical equations for a free particle, or a particle in a linear potential, or a particle in an oscillator potential. If you have a quadratic potential, the expectation values of position and momentum exactly follow the classical equations of motion. But if you have a departure from quadratic behavior, if you have a more complicated potential, then you'll begin to see some difference between the classical equations of motion and the equations of motion for a quantum mechanical particle, focusing only on the expectation value of position. Now, given that, the expectation value is not the whole story. Of course, in a quantum system, there's a whole distribution of the possible values of position, a whole distribution of possible values of momentum. Another way of putting that is that to describe the situation well, I'm going to have to tell you not just the expectation values, but maybe many higher moments of position and momentum to begin to get a good idea of the experimental facts of life. But that's another story. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up because I have to. Here's what I didn't cover. That's in my notes. Moving from something called the Schrodinger picture to something called the Heisenberg picture. So something I didn't cover today, I'll cover tomorrow. And that's where we'll pick up next time. So, see you later.